Hello and welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie. I'm Marie Westhaver.
And I'm Mike Giuliano.
And today we're going to talk about James Stewart, one of the biggest stars in American film, who has, you know, quite the, wholesome Boy Scout upbringing, which is probably where we should start, Mike.
Yes, we should talk about the Boy Scouts. That's true. People talk about that as an expression, somebody has a Boy Scout personality, but he really was. In fact, biographically, he's from Indiana, Pennsylvania, small town America, if you will, and has essentially what I call a kind of Midwestern sensibility, not that Pennsylvania is that, but, you know, next door to it, if you will. And indeed, the very first play that he ever appeared in was one that he really put together himself, and it was a Boy Scout play. So just as you would as a kid, you know, you put it on a show, that's what he did. And if I say this, it'll sound like I'm making fun. I'm not really. It's just by way of describing that kind of wholesome upbringing. Indeed, you know, when he went off to college at Princeton, he wasn't looking to be an actor necessarily. He actually was majoring in architecture, which you wouldn't guess necessarily for Jimmy Stewart. But the reason I mention the college background at this point is that among his accomplishments there, or his activities, let's put it that way, he was an accordion player, not unusual for that generation. Nowadays, you'd think, what, you play the accordion? I mean, quite common back then, but, you know, very wholesome activity. And he also was a cheerleader. And there's something of that sensibility there as well, you know, this optimistic, peppy, upbeat. And it's a reminder that really for Jimmy Stewart, and I know I didn't like to be called Jimmy, but I was calling Jimmy Stewart, for James Stewart, to be fully respectful. For James Stewart, there always was that sense of openness and honesty and idealism and just this good guy character. It's very much a personality-driven career. His persona is very much in, you know, all the roles he plays, and we're going to talk about many of them. But, you know, again, that sensibility goes back really to that childhood and the college years and so on. So we can talk some more about how he actually got into acting. And in terms of, you know, that early phase in college, it was actually Joshua Logan, you know, a theater and film personality himself, who got him interested in a company called the University Players in Falmouth, Massachusetts. So it was really like, you know, you're in college and you've done some acting and a friend says, hey, I got this summer theater company, you know, join us. And sure, why not? You do that. And as he got into it, his colleagues there actually were Henry Fonda, Margaret Sullivan, you know, of that generation, people coming out of college, going into acting jobs and so on. And Fonda, in fact, in a 1970 statement, said this about James Stewart as an actor, quote, no school actor he, instinctual, close quote. In other words, there's that sense with Jimmy Stewart that what you see is what's there, you know what I mean? It's not somebody who's going to study any kind of particular method of acting, if not, you know, method acting itself. It's just who he is. He's pulling from that natural personality. And in fact, Stewart himself, who didn't give many interviews, but he said this about himself in terms of his acting. He said, quote, I don't act, I react, close quote. So that kind of very understated, very natural, not at all pushy style of acting. And audiences like that. I mean, throughout his career, they responded to that quality.
You know, I think it's important to mention that he also served in the war, that he learned how to fly and in 1935 and was drafted into the U.S. Army in 1940 as a private. And I think that that war experience kind of ties into, you know, the good guy persona. I mean, he served his country, you know, he's patriotic. He actually, I believe, ended his career as a brigadier general. I mean, no slouch there. Also, you know, Princeton's a pretty good school to go and study architecture. So, you know, he had a lot to work with there in terms of building the character that was James Stewart for about America.
He was a great actor, but think about what a great architect he could have been. I mean, the loss to the world that he didn't follow through with that. Oh, well, another career. But let's linger a bit longer on that World War II service. Many American actors and directors, really famous names, including people he worked with, like Frank Capra and John Ford, enlisted in the military. They didn't need to be drafted. They signed up. They did their thing for their country. And many of them being film actors and film directors, what did they do? Well, they, you know, made documentary films typically for the war effort. Stewart went beyond that, above and beyond that. He was a bomber pilot. He flew combat missions. He won all kinds of medals. And yes, you know, eventually rose to a rank of a brigadier general. But during the war itself, He left Hollywood for several years. He stayed in the Army long past the point where he could have left. You know what I mean? He did his service and then he re-upped. He stayed in that way. And in terms of what that meant financially for him, when he was working in Hollywood, very early 1940s, he had a monthly salary of $12,000, which would be sweet now, but imagine what it was like then. That's a fortune. When he signed up for military service, his monthly salary initially as a private was $21 a month. Talk about taking a pay cut, and he did that. And in fact, that sensibility of being not just wholesome and idealistic and just cheerful the way we were talking about him, but the patriotism, that meant a lot to him during the war, and it would influence some of the roles he played and really his whole outlook on life. I mean, so you're absolutely right. It's crucial to mention that. And the final thing to say about the World War II services, by way of, the sacrifice essentially he made career-wise, he was a big Hollywood star when he left to go into the Army, right? And he's gone a few years and he's coming back to, being a few years older, but also Hollywood's changing. I mean, that's a really risky kind of thing to take a few years off like that. But, again, he stayed in uniform really right through the end of the war.
He also turned down all World War II films, saying that they were nothing like the actual war, which is kind of surprising. You would have thought he would, have been able to parlay his military experience into an on-screen persona that everybody would have loved. It's also interesting that in spite of the fact that he made a bunch of Westerns and frequently played John Wayne's sidekick, he was the decorated war hero where John Wayne never served in the military.
Well, that's a very sensitive point. Certainly it was for John Wayne. When you read biographies of John Wayne, he really made an effort to stay out of uniform. And it's a really loaded topic in terms of how people feel about him as an actor. But he stayed in Hollywood and, he made war-related films like they were expendable. I mean, he contributed to the war effort that way with some of the roles he played in the early and mid-1940s. But he didn't actually serve in the military. And yet, he'd be one of the biggest advocates for, military service and so on in later years. But it's such a loaded topic there in terms of, his personality, in terms of his conservative credentials, how people like or don't like what he represents. But you make a very good point that James Stewart actually was in uniform, flew over Germany, dangerous bombing missions and so on. And then ironically, after that, he would, be co-starring with John Wayne on occasion. And, people think of John Wayne in those terms, right? But it was actually James Stewart who really, deserves the medals and actually had the medals. But you're right. I think that experience informs his career choices later in terms of personal idealism and heroic efforts and all that. But ironically, he decided not to do like overtly World War II themed films. I mean, he pretty much shied away from that. And I think his reasons were valid. He knew what actual warfare was like. And he knew correspondingly how Hollywood tended to treat it. So imagine how he would feel if there was like a kind of tacked on Hollywood quality. And he'd say, well, no, it wasn't quite like that. So I think he was smart, actually, in some ways, not to appear in feature films that were portraying the war. Because, again, he knew just what it could be like. And it was not as glossy, not as upbeat, if you will, as Hollywood feature films tended to be, even when dealing with serious subject matter like that.
I think the roles he chose after returning from the war were generally darker. I think some people said that was because he was hardened by combat, but why don't we talk a little bit about the 1930s before things went dark?
Yeah, we should really. And he starts his film career in 1935. And the thing to remember is think about those personality attributes and think also about the voice, which we need to mention, not just because we're on radio, but the James Stewart voice. And again, even though when we talk about his personality, I have to remind myself, well, he's from small town Pennsylvania, but strikes me as having kind of what I call Midwestern personality. I mean, these are big generalizations, but the voice itself seems like it's pulling south, doesn't it?
It does.
And it's kind of hard to account for exactly why that is, but that distinctive vocal quality, the stuttering, the pauses, the delays, in many ways, that everyman quality, right? Nice guy, good guy, but, searching for the words, stumbling a little bit. He's not a Shakespearean actor. I'm getting that. It's not Laurence Olivier explaining himself. It's a nice everyday, your next door neighbor kind of guy explaining something. That's a large part of the appeal. I love that a critic once, writing about James Stewart's voice, described it as being like cornflakes and syrup. And that it was the exact expression that the critic used was cornflakes and syrup drawl. And the fact that it's drawn out really keeps you with him. And for an actor, actually, again, this is ironic. John Wayne had a very different speaking voice, but also shared that tendency to draw out words and draw out sentences. Wayne did it because once he finally became a movie star, well into his career, he wanted to keep that camera on him. And if he had one line of dialogue, he'd make it last 20 seconds rather than 10 seconds. You know, the camera is going to stay with him. And I'm not suggesting that Jimmy Stewart had similar motives at all whatsoever, but simply the irony that they both had a tendency to slow down as they were speaking. But then Stewart also had the ability to speed up, to rev up, to get nervous. And particularly in those mid to late 1930s films, think about it. This was the heyday for what's called screwball comedy. You know, fast patter, lines back and forth. In his case, those broken sentences, the stuttering, the drawn out, he'd go from a drawn out sentence to, you know, he's getting his blood pressure up, he's getting worked up. And so the character suddenly just, you know, starts talking a mile a minute. But for Stewart, of course, the sentences are still broken, a kind of staccato speaking pattern. And, you know, he did that in a lot of his comedies in that period. Think about The Philadelphia Story from 1940. Think about other films that have screwball qualities. And then certainly the work he did with Frank Capra, which really is the work, I think, that makes him a great actor and makes him recognized as such. Capra's 1938 film, You Can't Take It With You. It's screwball material, right? This nutty family, everyone's eccentric. You know, it's really light comedy, and he's really gifted at playing that kind of comedy. And there, as I say, his voice tends to speed up because of the nature of the material. Everyone's shouting, they're talking at once, they're even talking faster than I am, right? They're going on and on. And then that kind of nervous quality also serves him well for his other really great film with Capra in that period, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, 1939. And that really cements the reputation, I think, because he's this idealistic senator who finds himself in corrupt Washington. Has anything changed? And who gets on the floor and just makes this, you know, endless speech, this terrific monologue to hold the floor. And that's where you see everything operating full tilt for James Stewart in terms of that spontaneous, natural speaking ability, able to go from slow and deliberate to really hyperkinetic fast because he's all worked up emotionally. Those are films that really make his reputation. Philadelphia Story the next year wins him the Academy Award for Best Actor. So he's really on a terrific roll. He's become a major star. But it's not long after that, as we said earlier, that he goes into the Army. You know, like at the peak of his early career, he's absent then for a few years. But the public's perception of him, which is what you're asking about really, is that, you know, the good-natured, wholesome quality we keep talking about. But the fact that, you know, that's established by the late 30s, that's what people expect from Jimmy Stewart. And to your question directly, when he comes back from World War II, the world has changed. And I would wager, and you are as well, I think, that James Stewart is changing a bit as an actor. The roles often do become darker, more serious.
Although he does say, "I am James Stewart playing James Stewart. I couldn't mess around with the characterizations. I play variations on myself." But yes, I agree with you. He came back from the war and, you know, embraced some darker topics, including It's a Wonderful Life, which of course is what most people think of. And nope. You know, the drawling everyman, you know, the good guy where nothing goes right for him. And interestingly, that movie didn't do much when it came out, but now, of course, it's a classic and almost everybody's seen it at least 60 times per Christmas. Which also happened with some of his other movies. Vertigo also bombed, but now is considered, you know, a classic.
You're absolutely right, but the story behind It's a Wonderful Life is somewhat different in this respect. When Stewart came back from the war, he and Capra, Capra had been in the military too, making documentaries, right? And so when James Stewart came back from the war, he's getting back into motion pictures, and Capra was as well. Capra had set up his own film production company, Liberty Films. This is an era when the studios are starting to wobble just a little bit, where in any event, producers and directors are getting a little more independent clout. Anyway, Capra sets up his own company, Liberty Films, and It's a Wonderful Life is their inaugural production. And the film itself, you know, did reasonably well with the critics. It did not do well at the box office. Even though Stewart received an Oscar nomination and, you know, the film had that kind of media attention, it just didn't do well. The reason it did so well later and why the reputation changed was that because Liberty Films was a small company set up by Capra, somebody in the office at some point forgot to renew copyright. And what happened was the film went, it was free and open. And what happened was specifically independent television channels, you know, getting in the 60s and 70s, they're always looking for program that's either like free or cheap, right? And there was no copyright protection for a long time on It's a Wonderful Life. And they would just broadcast it, you know, not even just like, you know, annually for Christmas, which became the tradition, but it was just there to use. And so people discovered it or rediscovered it through all those TV broadcasts. And then that's what really brought a lot of folks around to saying, what a great film. Whereas in 1947, it just kind of came and went. It's a little difficult to say absolutely why it didn't go over so well in 1947, but it didn't. You're right. At the box office, it did not do well. Again, critically and with awards, it did actually pretty well there. The thing I'd really want to say about It's a Wonderful Life is, like James Stewart, playing a variation on himself. Yes, you're right. James Stewart plays James Stewart. When we think back on It's a Wonderful Life, particularly if we haven't seen it for a while, we tend to think of it in all these cheerful, uplifting, all-American ways, you know, and that's all in the film for sure. But when you actually watch the film, it's a very dark film. It really is depressing at times because he's, you know, he takes over the savings and loan from his father. He's staying in a small town. He's taking care of his family and his responsibilities. He never leaves town or gets the big break, whatever. And he's depressive, actually, right? I mean, after all, it's a film about a man who's about to commit suicide and then sees what would happen if he were no longer in the world. That's the fantasy element there. But as you watch that fantasy scene where he sees the world as it would have been without him, it's really jolting. It's really disturbing in places in terms of if he hadn't been there, the woman who became his wife, what would her life have been? And then right down the line in terms of friends and neighbors, it's really upsetting, actually. And yes, the film has a reassuring happy ending, but there are some rough emotional passages along the way. And so again, doubling or at this point, tripling back on your earlier point, Stewart in many ways, you know, plays variations on that wholesome character. And yet, particularly when he comes back from World War II, he takes roles that really stretch him a bit as an actor and also bring out aspects of his personality that we hadn't really seen to any great extent in the pre-war films.
Well, he, as the, you know, the universal everyman, who, by the way, I think Tom Hanks has taken over that mantle since Jimmy Stewart, where you can just sort of put him in almost any movie and he's so likable that people immediately identify with him. And I think he even addresses that, that people identify with him, but they want to be John Wayne. But I think that everyman quality is what made him so good in the Hitchcock films he made, Rear Window, Rope, Man Who Knew Too Much, and Vertigo. And in fact, he desperately wanted to be in North by Northwest, but Hitchcock, I think, was still angry that Vertigo hadn't done well at the box office and didn't want to use him. So he told him, you know, he thought he was too old, even though he used Cary Grant, who's actually 4 years older. But he's great in those Hitchcock movies because he has that quality of a normal person going about their regular life and then something really bizarre, creepy, or unusual happens, which is the underpinning of almost every Hitchcock film. And he's terrific in all of those, wouldn't you say?
He really is, because audiences are inclined to like him. I mean, we're conditioned that way. And his characters are likable in those films. I don't want to suggest otherwise. But we come in predisposed to liking whoever this particular character is going to be, right? But then as the film goes along, there are aspects of the character that are deeper, darker, all that. And so at that point, I'd say we're hooked. I like to use that expression, we're hooked, right? Because we identify, we empathize with this actor. He brings all that positive baggage, if I can put it that way. But the character he's playing now is somehow flawed or, you know, and in fact, you know, it's funny to talk about this point because in North by Northwest, Cary Grant also is a very likable actor. He brought those attributes to the role. And yet the character he plays, Roger Thornhill, this advertising executive, is really a very like selfish guy and drinks too much and is a bit of a womanizer. And you know, right down the line, some people would say, what's not to like there? But in any event, you know, the character is you know, self-centered and you know, not very nice to other people, always on and on that way. And yet because it's Cary Grant, I think we're inclined to go along with him even more than we might with a different actor. So ironically, Jimmy Stewart would have had many of those same attributes, even though they're very different in terms of persona, they have in common that kind of what I call likability factor. And that makes a difference. So think about the work that he did with Hitchcock, where he really is playing characters who are disturbing or even disturbed in some ways. I mean, just to reprise, like with Rear Window, think of the basic premise. He's a photojournalist. He's so absorbed in his career, going around the world that way for you know, picture magazines, he doesn't have enough time really for a serious relationship. the fact that Grace Kelly, would love to settle down and so on, but he's so into himself that way, and it's frustrating for her. What happens? Well, he's broken his leg on assignment. He's confined to his apartment in New York City. Out of boredom, as much as anything, he starts spying on his neighbors across the courtyard. I mean, it's one of the ultimate films about cinema as voyeurism, but in his case, in terms of the character, he's really kind of creepy at times, even in terms of the extremes to which he goes, like, with binoculars and telescopes, all sorts of things, to spy on his neighbors and to want to intervene. And, his nurse and his girlfriend all initially are kind of creeped out by that, the extreme to which they joke, but they're kind of creeped out about that. Think about Vertigo, where he plays a recently retired detective, police detective in San Francisco. And there, it's a friend who pulls him into, an assignment like, well, gee, my wife is mysterious and disappearing and I don't know what she's up to. Would you mind taking this on as a job and spying at her? But once he gets pulled into that, it really takes us not only deeper into the story, but into a character who has more than a fear of heights to deal with, right? I mean, there's a lot going on here. And these are, again, cases where James Stewart, likability is still there. And yet on the surface, even, he's less jokey, he's less lighthearted. There's a more serious kind of, and I won't say meditative, let's put it this way, a melancholic quality. Let's call it melancholic, that that his career and his personal life aren't everything that they should be or could be. And even though he's still capable of a joke, it's far, far removed from those screwball comedies of the late 30s into like 1940 or so. So again, it's an actor who, even though he's not thinking of himself as a, like, quote unquote, serious stage actor, Olivier type actor, he's got the acting chops, doesn't he? And, he really goes for roles in the later 40s and 50s and so on that really push him, I think, as an actor.
I love Rear Window in particular because it's such a great metaphor for watching movies, because there you are like he is. He's in a wheelchair. He is watching something taking place across the courtyard. And all he can do is watch. He cannot change anything or affect a different outcome. All he can do is just sit there helplessly and watch, which is kind of your experience in the theater. You're in the chair, you're watching the movie, and all you can do is watch and react. You can't make them do anything differently on the screen. I did want to make a passing reference to Harvey from 1950, because it's such an odd movie, and it's such an endearing movie about a guy who has a giant rabbit as a friend that only he can see. Not everybody could pull that off without it seeming goofy. But to move on from that, I'd like to mention some of his parts of his career where he did Westerns, which he really liked making. He said his favorite movies were Westerns because they're told against the background of a very dramatic period in our history and give people a feeling of hope, an affirmative statement of living. And he certainly made a lot of great Westerns. I do want to mention, though, that both Jimmy Stewart and Richard Widmark wore toupees and had hearing problems. So on the set of Two Road Together from 1961, director John Ford became frustrated with them being unable to hear him and said, 50 years in this business, and what do I end up doing? Directing two deaf hair pieces. He also wore the same hat in all of his Westerns, if you noticed, and John Ford complained about that too. Great, now that I have actors with hat approval.
It's funny that you had to bleep John Ford, because John Ford in interviews and anywhere, he was so gruff, such a curmudgeon, right? That, he always is this hard-drinking, hard, tough-talking character here. But it's funny you mentioned Two Road Together in particular, because that was a John Ford film from 1961, where Ford liked working with James Stewart. They worked together a few times. And Ford, in his own kind of pithy, gruff way, was talking about James Stewart as an actor, specifically in that film. And he said, quote, people just seem to like him, close quote. That's actually a long quote from John Ford by his standards. But, again, that's that likability factor. And so what happens in the Westerns is, you still have that sense in a Western of, who wears the white hat, who wears the black hat, good guys, bad guys, whatever. But Stewart, could retain that essential good character and yet be involved in films that call some of those very things into question, right? And his own character sometimes has got some darker shadings as well. So he worked most often, well, first of all, what's interesting is when we think about James Stewart as an actor, we think about the Frank Capra films from the 1930s, we think about, or It's a Wonderful Life, the Capra film from 1947, we think about the work he did in all those comedies. And we think about the Hitchcock films, you know, light to dark, mostly dark. And yet what we don't tend to focus on enough is the fact that genre-wise, James Stewart made more Westerns than any other genre he worked in. He worked a lot with John Ford, but, you know, films like, you know, Man Who Shot Liberty Valance and so on. But he also worked a lot with Anthony Mann, films like Winchester 73 and so on. All these films in the 50s that are Westerns. And when you hear the name James Stewart, you recognize the film titles, but you might not initially think, yeah, star of Westerns.
And I think The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance is my favorite Western, but I also really, really liked him in The Shootist, which was the last film he made with John Wayne, who's also really excellent in it, you know, about two aging cowboys coming to the end of their lives. Do you have a favorite Jimmy Stewart Western, Mike?
Probably the same as you, Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. But, you know, think about those late films, The Shootist, for instance, Cheyenne Autumn, 1964, where he plays Wyatt Earp, late in John Ford's career, late in James Stewart's career, John Wayne's as well. The Westerns do, to use a word I used earlier, have a melancholic quality, don't they? It's that the West itself has been settled and the characters are aging, and so are the actors and directors who are involved in the films. And there's that melancholic quality that you find late in life. And actually, it allows for the films themselves to have a somewhat more leisurely pace sometimes. There's a kind of contemplative quality there. But I think, you know, he definitely made some really great Westerns. He also did some more routine ones. And that's where the critics, I recently read a book which discussed every single film James Stewart ever made. And it quoted critics, like initial movie reviews. And oftentimes they'd say, well, it's not a great movie. And Jimmy Stewart is just playing Jimmy Stewart, but you could do worse than that.
I think one of his strengths is that people just like spending time with him, even if it's, you know, just in a movie. I think he's just works that persona. And it doesn't seem phony. You know, you mentioned how he was, you know, very natural actor. He didn't have any formal acting training. He thought it was something you're just supposed to, you know, be yourself and let the character kind of come out of you. And I think he does that better than most. I'm going to end with a quote where Jimmy Stewart said this: I have my own rules and adhere to them. The rule is simple but inflexible. A James Stewart picture must have two vital ingredients. It will be clean, and it will involve the triumph of the underdog over the bully. And I think he manages to get that across in every one of his movies. What do you think, Mike?
I think it's a terrific quote, really, because when you look at a career which encompassed 80 films, bear in mind these studio era actors went from film to film. So particularly like in the 30s, 40s, 50s, he kept working. Not every film's a great film, and yet people do want to watch him. And it really makes, you know, some mediocre films more than mediocre. In other words, you watch it for the actor. But what we've been highlighting today really are some of his great roles. Like if you're looking for James Stewart films to watch, some of the really great films for John Ford and Alfred Hitchcock and Frank Capra and so on, and some others beyond that. But that short list is actually rather long for James Stewart. He appeared in some really terrific films.
You really can't go wrong looking up anything that he's done, because if nothing else, it's going to be James Stewart playing James Stewart in whatever it is, which is a plus. Which brings us to the end of our episode. Don't forget to check out our other episodes on dragondigitalradio.podbean.com. And we will see you at the movies.
See you then.
Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.